temptation as the only way to avert a climate apocalypse and atone for man's crimes against the earth. In his campaign, US President Joe Biden set a very different tone. His climate plan would make building a new zero-emission infrastructure for the United States into a vehicle for restoring prosperity and high-wage employment. But what will President Biden's clean energy future look like? And will it be economically sustainable? A policy of attempting to achieve 100% clean electricity without massive expansion of nuclear energy will inevitably mean subjecting the population to economic austerity, among other things, through exorbitantly high energy prices and taxes, resulting in a loss in buying power and most likely rationing and regimentation in the use of electricity. Plus, blackouts. To get a bitter taste of that future, we have only to look at California, the state that has taken the lead in clean energy. California also leads with the highest energy prices outside of the Northeast, more than 50% higher than the national average, and the highest real poverty rate in the United States. California is supposed to be the showcase of the Democratic Party's environmental policies. The state has been solidly in Democratic hands since the election of environmentalist Governor Jerry Brown in 2011. Vice President Kamala Harris and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi are leading California Democrats. California also has vast financial and economic resources. If California were a country, it would be one of the six richest nations in the world, with a nominal gross domestic product of $2.6 trillion. So why is this state not able to provide its citizens with reliable and affordable electric power? Throughout October of last year, millions of Californians suffered from a constant series of rolling blackouts in which electricity supply was cut off to various regions of the state on a rotating basis. Rolling blackouts were provoked by a severe heat and dry spell, but were made possible by the desolate state of the state's ancient electric power grid. Sparking from its overland power lines had long been a main trigger of California's frequent forest fires. To avert this danger during the heat wave, California's main supply company, Pacific Gas and Electricity, PG&E, simply cut off electricity to entire areas, calling these events public safety power shutoffs. Pacific Gas and Electricity, the largest power company in the United States and greatly concerned to cultivate its image as a pioneer in clean energy, had evidently given more priority to investing in solar and wind power than maintaining the power grid. The crisis was also caused by insufficient reserves of generation capacity, including the environmentally motivated reduction in natural gas-based power generation and closing of the next-to-last nuclear plant, as well as phasing out of fossil fuel plants in neighboring states, which reduced the amount of electricity that could be imported. With net imports amounting to 25% of its supplies, California is the largest importer of electricity in the United States. Then there were the large fluctuations in supply from wind turbines, with swings of up to 1,000 megawatts, and the unavailability of solar power at night. At a certain point, the situation got out of hand. The latest crisis was no surprise for those familiar with California's energy system. California already led the country in the number of power outages per year, and the system had already come near to collapse in the preceding months. More important than mere blackouts, California gives a foretaste of the economic austerity that ideologically driven climate measures threaten to bring to the whole country. 2 years ago, a coalition of civil rights leaders calling themselves the 200 brought a legal suit against the California Air Resources Board, or CARB, the main agency of the California government responsible for implementing climate policies. The lawsuit charged these policies were systematically violating the rights of minority citizens in the state, particularly those living in poverty. By the U.S. Census Bureau's functional poverty criteria, 18% of Californians are considered poor. California's environmental measures have been hitting the living standards of the poorer population in multiple ways. Rapidly increasing cost of electricity, plus 30% since 2011, compared with a 4% average increase in the rest of the United States. Growth in the cost of housing arising from obligatory energy efficiency measures in old and new buildings and other environmental regulations. Moves towards banning the use of natural gas for heating and cooking, forcing people to turn instead to the use of electricity, which is nearly four times more expensive. Increased transportation costs due to environmental taxes on motor fuels and a new vehicle miles traveled fee, designed to reduce emissions from car driving, but de facto punishing people who move to outlying areas in search of affordable housing. President Joe Biden and his team are well aware of the link between climate policy and austerity. It has been a major issue at the base of the Democratic Party, with an ideologically driven leftist constituency on one side and traditional Democratic constituencies such as trade unions on the other. The latter, from experience and common sense, fear they will end up paying for the clean energy policies with lower living standards and also increased unemployment. For example, what will happen to the millions of persons whose livelihoods depend, directly or indirectly, on coal mining, natural gas, and oil extraction activities? One should bear in mind the colossal size of the fossil fuel sector in the United States economy. The United States is currently the largest oil producer in the world, the largest natural gas producer, and the third largest hard coal producer. A radical reduction in fossil fuel production would hit not only the 1.1 million people directly employed in these activities, but also the economies of entire regions in states such as Wyoming, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Texas, North Dakota, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. Needless to say, most of these regions voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in the last election. President Joe Biden knows this, of course. In executive orders, he promises that 40% of the benefits of the $2 trillion climate plan will go to disadvantaged communities. Biden claims that large numbers of people in these communities will find employment in the process of shutting down the fossil fuel sector, such as closing down mines, sealing off oil wells, dismantling pipelines, restoring the surrounding, often severely damaged environment, decommissioning fossil fuel plants. This may be partly true, although the jobs involved have only a marginal effect on the productivity of the U.S. economy. But what happens later? The experiences of the Rust Belt, resulting from the deindustrialization of the United States Midwest and parts of the Northeast in the 1980s, are not particularly encouraging. This looks good at first glance, but it reflects the fact that solar and wind energy are extremely labor-intensive and have intrinsically low productivity. This is due, among other things, to the huge number of units that must be installed and maintained in order to reach a given output level. The critical question is whether the U.S. economy, after having spent all the money and resources to reach 100% clean energy, will be more or less productive. The answer depends crucially and the choices of technology. President Joe Biden emphasized in his campaign, a key plank of our Build Back Better recovery plan is building a modern, resilient climate infrastructure and clean energy future that will create millions of good-paying union jobs, not $7, $8, $10, $12 an hour, but prevailing wage and benefits. However, if irrational environmentalist policies collapse the real productivity of the economy, then real wages and real living standards will inevitably collapse too, at least for the majority of the working population. Large injections of money might create the opposite impression, but, as in the case of every anesthetic, the effect eventually wears off.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we will follow Javad Gharai, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good, long trip in the winter. Hi, I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts, Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands, to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian Mountains. Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the National Heritage List. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant. But you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming. I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian Mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Floodwaters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadi Cave, It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Sheer Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Berries to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The valley, I mean the Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Baluchistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts, but I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berries Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berries Village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berries. The villagers moved from Old Berries to New Berries around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berries Wharf. Thank you. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Baluchistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where old Baris used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in new Baris. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Baluchistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course. The main occupation of the people of Baris is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea for their livelihood. Some strike out to the sea in small boats and throw their small nets in to catch fish. Others go out in wooden launches, which could be called the biggest of man-made contraptions. They go out to sea and spend months fishing. These large wooden motorboats are equipped with proper refrigerators and air conditioning for the crew. The fishermen here say they are not happy with their catches in recent years. They say marine life populations have shrunk drastically. The declining numbers of fish in seas and oceans has its cause in different and important reasons. The first reason behind the decrease in the numbers of marine life around the world is the boom in the human population on Earth. The growth in the human population has led to a larger demand for fish and in turn to overfishing by those in the fishing industry. Operations that are carried out via large ocean-going trawlers fitted with radars and other high-tech equipment. Ships that have nets running several kilometers and by means of radars can trap thousands of fish in every attempt in the depths of oceans. In almost every catch, these ships bring home fish weighing upwards of 300,000 kilos altogether. Industrial fishing and the overconsumption of marine life by humans leaves the fish no time to reproduce, pushing many species to the brink of extinction. In a recent survey, researchers at the University of British Columbia found that in half a century, human consumption has pushed down big fish populations by 90%, fish that are in high demand on the market. They have predicted that if serious action is not taken against overfishing by developed countries, all these species of fish will have gone extinct by 2050. Marine life populations are on the decline, which will have dire consequences for humans and the environment alike. The ecosystems of seas and oceans are intertwined with the lives of humans and the environment they live in. They are all very fragile. Iran accounts for only a small portion of the marine life caught around the world. The reasons being high prices, the small share the marine animals have of the Iranian diet, and the absence of advanced fishing vessels in the country. But European countries, the United States, Japan, and many other developed countries play an important role in the destruction of marine ecosystems. They have done more damage to the environment than any other country in the world. and this is a result of a boom in their populations, a change in consumption patterns, and the lifestyle of the people living in those countries. There are two other important reasons that have contributed to the dwindling numbers of marine animals: contamination and global warming. Berries is a very beautiful wharf. It was built at the foot of the Berries cliffs, offering a spectacular view. Launches and boats return here with their catch of the day to sell their prized sea creatures to the middleman. Beautiful the fellow is. The local fishermen here call it the kilkita in their local dialect. It's so colorful. Unfortunately, she too is still carrying her eggs. They get caught in the fisherman's net in this season. Most of those I've seen were ready to spawn. This is their time to reproduce, but they don't get the chance to do it. They are pulled out of the water along with the thousands of eggs that they are carrying in their abdomens. Poor thing is struggling to get out of my hand. Just look how beautiful it is. So colorful. After my visit to Berry's Wharf, I set off on a walking journey along the shores of the Sea of Omaha. Of course, I'll be walking on the cliffs all along. The view from atop the cliffs in Berries is simply matchless. Fortunately, there aren't constructions of any kind up here. The area is an asset for Balochistan and indeed for Iran because of its pristineness. I hope to see the same unspoiled beauties and pristineness the next time I visit this part of my country and its beautiful landscape. I hope more and more tourists come to visit Balochistan. Nature travelers go to places that are pristine and untouched in order to immerse themselves in the peace and quiet that those places offer. Beautiful rocky cliffs that you see here are where Berries begins. Those are the shores of Berries, among the most beautiful of our beloved country, Iran. But the bluff along the shore is crumbling into the sea. The waves lap at the walls made up of millennia-old sediments that settled on the bottom of the Sea of Oman that used to cover this whole area. The bluff is capped by a 2-meter-high layer of rock, like the one I'm sitting on right now. It feels like reinforced mortar with all the shells and algae in it, fossils that have been here for thousands, or should I say millions, of years. But the layers underneath are weak and brittle, allowing the waves to chip away at them one bit at a time. The green blocks or rocks that you see on the coast are in fact the top layer of the cliff. They used to be up where I am right now. It's going to take the waves some time to turn them into sand and dissolve them in the water. It's about 60 meters down to the foot of the cliff, and as you can see, a huge slice of the cliff has splintered from the rest, or should I say from Berry's territory, and will crash into the sea one of these days. So I better cross onto the other side because it's dangerous to stand here. I really don't want to go down with it. This gaping crack here is almost 10 meters deep, but it's very likely for it to be much deeper in other parts. It's too dark for me to see. This is a very dangerous spot.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Fighting in the way of Allah is one of the Islamic instructions that is there in the context where it applies. You'll have people that will classify themselves, identify as pacifists, people who just don't like war. A Muslim cannot be a pacifist. If they are, they're not Muslim. Or they don't at least understand that that contradicts their faith. You can't be. Islam says, قَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. You have to fight in the way of Allah. Yeah, you're not supposed to go and just start killing people. But there are times, pacifism, no, avoid war. We are against war. A Muslim is not against war. A Muslim is against a war that is not just. In fact, the Quran says, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Al-Hadid says, we sent prophets with the book, with mizan, لِيَقُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْقِسْطِ وَأَنزَلَ الْحَدِيدِ فِيهِ بَأْسٌ شَدِيدٌ. We sent down iron that is used for all the different weaponry. Iron is used فِيهِ بَأْسٌ شَدِيدٌ in order to implement justice. Hadid is required. Those who think that, oh, let's put that aside, that's not how you get to justice according to Islam, according to Allah, according to wisdom, according to really understanding conditions and circumstances, that's not possible. That's never going to be possible. In fact, one of the verses that we had, one of the interpretations towards the end, it says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, لَوْلَا دَفْعُ اللَّهِ النَّاسِ بَعْضَهُمْ بَعْضًا or بَعْضَهُمْ بِبَعْضًا لَفَسَدَتِ الْأَرْضِ. Okay, there's two verses that have a similar language. Allama Tabatabai says one of them is in regards to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala supporting one group of people against the other. And one of them, and I think it may be this one, that is telling us that war is something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brought about in the context of human beings. And that's a reality. You know, if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is in charge and you have war, that means He brought it about. It's not that it just came about on its own. This notion that human beings create, God didn't want it, human beings created it, that contradicts Tawheed. And it contradicts these verses of the Quran. It contradicts Tawheed. Anything in the world and everything in the world is something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has willed. Without the will of Allah, nothing will happen. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Nothing will exist. Nothing will happen. If a person does not agree with the Islamic teaching, even if it never applies to them, their iman is going to be deficient, it will be weak, it will remain incomplete. In order to complete the faith, you need to believe in every single thing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said. If you don't agree with it, you don't believe in it, your faith is not going to be complete. Besides that, encouraging those who it does apply to. If you look at those verses that were read, the whole story that's given there is the story of Banu Israel, Saul, David, and Goliath. This story is given in these verses. Because when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, قَالُوا قَتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ, there were those of the believers that were saying, let's not do this. And today, for the believers that it applies to, some say, let's not do this. Some are telling Hashd al-Sha'bi, don't hit back. Do not hit. Don't target American bases. Although the base that was targeted with a few Katyusha rockets, that was not Hashd al-Sha'bi. Hashd al-Sha'bi does not play games. If they want to get you guys, they're not going to use Katyusha missiles to get you. That's the old days of Hezbollah. As old days. A few decades old that they used to use Katyusha missiles. These guys are your own guys that are doing this. They're trying to frame Hashd al-Sha'bi. There are people that are suggesting to these believers, don't fight. When they unleashed their terrorist groups that they created and gave Islamic names and flags and literature and platforms and everything in Syria, there were those who were encouraging the Islamic Republic not to fight. There were those who were encouraging Hezbollah not to fight. They were encouraging Hashr al-Sha'bi, the Iraqis that wanted to come, and they were there from the beginning. There were already some Iraqis in Damascus. Some of them got involved, then from Iraq they started coming, they got involved. There were those who were saying, well, this is Syria, you guys don't get involved in this. It's a taklif. In Palestine, there are those who are saying, let's not go. This is, you know, they're calling Hamas a terrorist organization, Jihad Islami a terrorist organization. That's not the way forward. What do we need to do in negotiation? Negotiation what? They agreed, supposedly, as they do. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us they do not uphold any type of agreement. If they are in power, if you allow them, if you're not harsh, وَغْلُضْ عَلَيْهِمْ, if you don't have that, you're not harsh against them where they don't feel like they can even approach you, if you're not like that, you have open arms, you try to embrace them, you say, yeah, first they'll come in as immigrants, then they'll start forming groups, bringing weapons, then they'll start throwing you out, as they did with the Palestinians. And they say, okay, negotiations. After they took all that land, negotiations, they said, all right, we'll give you guys this much of it. You guys can have a state. Up to today, where is the Palestinian state? Even based on the agreements. Forget about, we don't agree with that. From the river to the sea, that whole thing is Palestine. There's no such thing as Israel. This is an illegitimate creation. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will take it away with the help of the mu'mineen. They need to fight. That's the way forward. It's not going to go away by itself. And it's not going to go away with negotiations. It's going to go away by fighting. That's how it's going to go away. They have got to fight. This is the point. When they wanted to fight, there were those that were saying, well, let's not do this. You're going to get all these people killed. Well, you negotiated how many more people got killed. How many more people are going to get killed? It's not simply to believe the cases where it applies. It needs to happen and people need to be involved. We have a responsibility to do amr bil ma'roof. Ma'roof is qital fi sabilillah in certain cases, wherever it applies. In the case of Yemen, it applies. In the case of Bahrain, it applies. They need to do qital fi sabilillah. You can't just, there's got to be, when they bring guns, they start shooting you people, you can't say, well, we'll just come. No, there's got to be weapons. You got to have qital fi sabilillah. Yes, come out, people come out, demonstrations, all that. But when they bring out guns, you can't say, okay, we're not going to have guns. We're just going to keep coming. Kill us all, we're going to send a few hundred more people, let them get killed as well. Who said that? Where did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala say that? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given idhn, those who've been oppressed, they've been killed. Now you have, yes, in Mecca, the conditions were not there. Allah said, be patient. Don't fight. This is not the time. They went to Medina, war's begun. Battle of Badr, the battle of Uhud, the battle of... And you say, okay, they're going to come and kill us, just stand here. No. La ilaha illallah. Allah save us, we're just going to stand here? No. قَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. That applies to the people of Iraq against their invaders. In Syria, it applies where to fly. We have a responsibility to understand, to believe, if it applies to us, to implement. And where it applies to others, amr bil ma'roof, you guys need to do this, it's your responsibility to do this. While others are saying you shouldn't do this, we have a responsibility to support them. We have a responsibility in Islam. Brothers, sisters, this is another practical aspect of this. People are like, let's not talk about Hamas. You have it. Yeah, qital doesn't apply to you. You have a responsibility to encourage Hamas to fight Israel. You say, we have a responsibility to encourage Hezbollah to fight against Israel. Encourage Jihad Islami to fight against Israel. It's a responsibility. Islam gives us this responsibility. Doesn't matter who makes what law. No law stands in the way of the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This notion that as Muslimin we are supposed to abide by the laws of the governments that we live under regardless of what they are is completely false. I've seen people, they quote fatwa of Maraja and say, oh, you have to... No, that's not what the fatwa says. There is no such fatwa. The fatwa is the laws that don't go against Islam. Since you agree, those who come in, this doesn't even apply to those who are born here. Those who come in, you sign a document there, you make an agreement with the kuffar that I will come to your country, I will abide by your laws. You're only allowed to agree to abide by laws that do not go against Islam. If they go against Islam, you have no right to accept that. Nobody has a right to set any law against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's law. No matter who puts what type of law, it is your responsibility as a Muslim to encourage Hamas, Jihad al-Islami, Hezbollah, and whoever fights the Zionist regime, it's your responsibility to support them.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Hello there, welcome to the lighter side of the news. It's great to have you with us. Now, the first gorilla born in the Berlin Zoo in 16 years finally has a name. The naming day was celebrated with no visitors due to the coronavirus pandemic. However, zookeepers made the day special for the tiny Tila and her first-time mother with their favorite treats. The baby was born in mid-February. After a few weeks, the zoo received over 17,000 name suggestions for her. The low number of female firefighters across the world may indicate women's lack of interest in the job. But this female-only Brazilian firefighter crew is here to prove the opposite. The all-female team say their main goal is to empower women through the work they do. They say they are willing to prove that women can take any job that can help society. The firefighting crew started their activity just on Monday on International Women's Day. They work in southeastern Brazilian state. Although women have a variety of fire service roles in different countries, they account for less than 20% of firefighters worldwide.
Plastic waste has become a global environmental challenge, causing frustration among residents as recycling is not common everywhere. But a Filipino artist has grabbed the opportunity to turn trash into treasure. Since 2019, Jaber Angels has been transforming plastic waste, especially non-recyclable trash, into beautiful paintings. He has so far made over 24 artworks by scattering shredded plastic bits across his canvas. The artist also uses expired paint and leftover wood from demolished homes. Angel said he gets some of these materials from around his neighborhood, while the rest is given to him by donors. He says that he got the idea to put waste to good use when he found out that his country is one of the world's top plastic waste producers.
We are the third contributor of plastic waste into the ocean, the third in the world. When I found out about that, I had to think of ways to raise awareness and knowledge on the reasons why we contribute this much waste.
The artist's works have been displayed in famous galleries in the Philippines. They have sold for prices ranging from a few hundred to a few thousand dollars. And Jess has also created an advocacy group called Green Arts, aimed at encouraging artists to use recycled waste for their work. And China's commercial hub, Shanghai, is not only filled up with skyscrapers, but this cosmopolitan city has many incredible things to attract domestic and foreign tourists as well. Unofficial statistics show Shanghai is China's de facto capital of animal cafes, which are growing in terms of numbers and the variety of species that they host. There are now all kinds of animal coffee shops there. One of these venues is filled with cute furry raccoons, which sometimes tug at customers' clothes while they are served their food. In another cafe, clients can enjoy the company of outlandish reptiles as they sip hot drinks. Those who frequent these bistros say the activity helps them relax and forget the hustle and bustle of city life. An advert showcasing a bowling alley has become an instant hit online by combining expert drone flying techniques and impressive filmmaking skills. The 90-second-long one-take video is titled Right Up Our Alley. The journey begins with a drone flying over the Bryant Lake Bowl in the U.S. city of Minneapolis before swooping inside the venue at a remarkable speed. The device then flies over bowling lanes and small passageways, taking the audience on a tour of the entire facility. The footage ends by the drone crashing into the bowling pegs. The video has already racked up millions of views online.
Yeah, I think there's some skepticism there of it being a true one take. It is a true one take. There's no CGI. You know, that was kind of interesting, but also the positive nature of it, of people seeing the skill that it takes and the unique ability to, like, combine the skill of an amazing pilot, the technology of the drone, and the story that, and thank you, the story that actually can be told through a one take.
The footage was shot by a quadcopter drone. It took the pilot and the director about 10 to 12 attempts over 2 hours to produce the perfect take. The filmmakers undertook the project free of charge. Their aim was to help local businesses recover from the coronavirus-related losses.
A Swedish scuba diver is using his skills to clean up the underwater environment.
My name is Fredrik Johansson, and 2 years ago I started up a project called Rena Malarin. We have two goals. One is to get a lot of toxic waste up from the water, and the other thing is to make people aware of this planet and to do better.
A number of Swedish scuba divers have voluntarily joined Johansson's program. They pull out harmful waste and trash from waterways and lakes. Johansson says he is shocked by the number of polluting fragments discovered in the Swedish marine environment. He says one of the main polluting factors is lead batteries discarded from boats. He says many waterways in the capital Stockholm are littered with these used batteries.
A new study has revealed a sad fact. Humans have destroyed around two-thirds of the world's tropical rainforests. According to a report by Rainforest Foundation Norway, logging and land conversion has ruined 34% of tropical rainforests. They have also caused degradation of another 30%, which makes the forest more vulnerable to fire and destruction. The report says that since 2002, over half of the vanishing has occurred in South America's Amazon. Experts believe the loss of tropical forests makes climate change worse. Japan is famous for its vending machines, but the technology is now being used to improve public access to coronavirus test kits. A group of medical experts in a clinic has set up 7 vending machines across the capital, Tokyo, to sell their test kits. Customers take the PCR test and then mail off their saliva sample for processing. Each machine holds 60 kits. The idea was met with great enthusiasm from people. It helps them to avoid crowded clinics.
Without PCR tests, we can't make a diagnosis. Early diagnosis and early treatment is a basic idea for all diseases. But unfortunately, there is no treatment for COVID-19. so I strongly felt that we had to do early diagnosis and early isolation.
Experts believe the number of PCR tests conducted in Japan is extremely low. They hope that the initiative can increase the figure. The machines sell the kits at around $40 each.
Teams of racing dog enthusiasts have converged on the Russian city of Irkutsk to participate in a 150-kilometer marathon on ice. The contest was held on the icy surface of the famous Baikal Lake. The racers, who started off at 5 p.m., had to put up tents and use warm equipment to withstand temperatures as low as minus 12 degrees Celsius to spend the night. Participants are free to choose their tactics throughout the race.
What's good about this race is its straightforward format. Now the racers start off and we will stop the clock when they arrive. Where they sleep and eat and how they cover the distance is a matter of their personal strategy and tactics. This is a contest for the real athletes.
The dogs can help their owners find the right direction in case they are lost on the frosty path. They can seek help from other rivals too. The Baikal race is an annual event that was held for the seventh consecutive time this year.
Get ready for a big dose of cuteness. In India, dozens of little turtles have been released into sea. Forest officials in a southern Indian town let loose 131 endangered turtle hatchlings. They had kept the eggs for over 50 days until the day came to set them free. The environmentalists also plan to release four other cute turtles, which are still too shy to come out of their cozy eggs. Marine turtles have existed for more than 100 million years. The numbers have fallen in the past few years due to human activities. Moving on, NASA's Mars rover Dot Perseverance has successfully completed its first ever test drive on the red planet. The six-wheeled rover traveled more than 6 meters in 33 minutes. NASA officials called the mission a huge milestone. They also released images showing the robot's wheel tracks on the surface of the planet and surrounding landscape. NASA engineers say they are now preparing for the first flight of a helicopter drone carried by the rover. Perseverance was launched last summer and landed on Mars earlier in February. Its main goal is to search for traces of ancient microbial life there. It is going to collect soil and rock samples from the Martian surface and send them back to the Earth in the next decade for analysis.
An Australian conservation group says it will build the world's first ever platypus refuge facility.
We're also going to build a platypus refuge, one of its kinds around the world. This refuge will be able to take up to 65 platypuses in a time of crisis. Right now there is so much to learn about the platypus, and we know so little. These facilities will be critical in building our knowledge so that we don't let this iconic creature slip off the earth.
Platypuses are among Australia's most unique and elusive animals. They're normally found across the country's eastern seaboard. The strange-looking creatures are the only remaining representatives of their family. They spend most of their lifetime underwater and alone. Australian authorities say the planned refuge facility can give them more information about the animal's preferred environment and breeding. Many habits of the platypuses have remained a mystery to researchers.
That's a wrap-up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
IRIB English Radio.